Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, it's almost a year since we went to the polls in New Zealand. October the 14th, 2023 was the day. And on November 23, 2023, a coalition agreement was formed. In between those two dates, we actually had a panel on RCR Greenwashed of three former Federated Farmers presidents. And we thought we'd better get them back in the House today to give their one-year review, the good, the bad, and the ugly, perhaps you might say, of the coalition's performance in the first 12 months. And of course, we had recently Bryce McKenzie from Groundswell on, and I asked him what he thought was the report card for the government or the coalition in their first 360 days. And he said, oh, I'd give them a 5 out of 10. Now, was that harsh or was that too soft? So to get another view on it, we've got Owen Jennings, Charlie Pedersen and Katie Milne, all former presidents of Federated Farmers. And so welcome back to RCR Greenwashed. So look, let's start with you, Owen. What's your view of the last 365 days odd from the coalition's performance? What's the good? What's the bad? What's left to do?
I think Bryce was far too hard on them. I mean, I'd give them a 5.5. the problem with today is the world's run, particularly the New Zealand world's run by technocrats, not by politicians. And, you know, the politicians have abdicated their role or had it taken off them because they aren't smart enough. And so we've got not just bureaucrats, but technocrats, scientists, goodness knows what all, telling us what to do, how to do it, when to do it, and why we should. And what I would like to see is a government that's got far more nous, far more ability, you know, far shrewder, I guess, in terms of what they want to achieve. I mean, coming into the second year and we still haven't got even the bones of a reform for the RMA on the table, I think is bad news, because they should have been ready to go. And I can recall talking to a number of politicians before the election saying, get your RMA stuff ready to roll out as soon as you hit the table, because 3 years is not very long. And we're not all that far away from the time when you've got to say, gee, we've got an election coming. We better have a look where the lolly bag is, and we better, you know, get people conditioned ready for the election. So I think they've done some good things. They've moved quite categorically and quite decisively in several areas that were essential. But I think they were behind the ballpark on day one, and they're struggling to catch up, and they need to get the rest of the reform aspects that they were facing underway very promptly.
Yeah, well, good point, Owen. In fact, 2008, 2011, I remember when John Key first came into power. That was my time as president. And we actually had the RMA reform program all ready for them to pick up off our table. And it was Business New Zealand, or perhaps it was the Round Table in those days. We had it all done for them. So you'd wonder what's different today, or was this typical Wellington machinery in play where they just bury it and get another job another day? I'm being a bit cynical. Katie, what was your view of the first 365 days of the government?
Hi, Don. Well, I actually think that it's, well, we all know you've got the middle year is the year of doing, so we're coming to that now. And I think there was a lot of unwinding of 6 years of bureaucratic systems in government and in councils that they have a big job to stop that ship and slow it down and turn it around. You know, they've cut a fair few numbers, cut some jobs and all those things to help start that process and to achieve what they had in all the manifestos of cutting that back. I know they've ended up spending more in the meantime, but I think we shouldn't underestimate how hard that is when you've had people who have been in a certain system and working a certain way for so long, to actually get them to change their pace and change their direction and, as you say, unbury some things or shift their own biases into your mode is harder than we think. That's cultural change, and that is hard to do. So I think they've done better than what the two previous marks were that they've been given, and they're definitely moving in those areas that will make meaningful change for New Zealand, you know, around infrastructure and being able to get energy done by the, you know, like to the ultimate renewal through when the RMA fast track, the things that are in there, you know, hydro, run of the river is back on the tables, things like that that were completely taken off. So there's some fundamental stuff that it doesn't change that quickly overnight as much as we would want it to. And I do believe they all had good policies that they wanted to implement on the ground and ready to go. But there's that piece in between where you've got to get everyone else on board. And it's quite different. I mean, when the first original coalition came in with Labor, the Greens and New Zealand First, they had all those massive working groups. Now, that hasn't had to happen this time. So there hasn't been a heap of lost time and wasted energy in reports that never got ultimately utilised anyway. So I think they're doing a better job than perhaps the 5.5. I think it's a lot better. But the best is yet to come.
Right, that's good to hear. I mean, it was easy to say the ute tax is gone. That was pretty simple. But there's so many other big ticket things that you're right, the ship seemed to take a lot of turning around. And, you know, repealing the three waters, yeah, that was useful. But it seems that even as recently as last week, the minister had to make some noises to stop councils using what was likely to be changed, but the councils just hadn't changed their direction. So that was an issue. Yeah. So going on to Charlie, you've always got a unique view on these things. What did you sort of see the last 365 days doing for the ag sector predominantly, but for New Zealand as well, I dare say?
Thanks, Don. I think that I'd score it a little differently to what Owen said, but not much higher. So I think the main thing that's impressed me about the coalition government is how cohesive it seems to be. And so they've got their structure right, and I think that shows in the way that the Prime Minister Luxon Scott has got confidence to allow the leaders of the other parties to speak out, show a bit of colour instead of black and white. So I think that part, having that right, augurs really well for it being a really effective government for the foreseeable, well, until it gets voted out, I guess. So that, I think that's a really, really good sign. There's no clunkiness at this stage as much as the opposition and the media would like to try and find little bits to chip away at where there seems to be a difference in position. They're just not finding them. So I think that's... if that was led by Luxon, then I'd give him a 9 out of 10 for setting up that structure, because it's very, very good. Now, their performance, however, you know, I'd go a little bit higher than Owen and Laurie, and probably give them a 6, which I might be a bit with about where Katie is, I guess. And that means that they've got a lot of things in play, but, you know, the old school teacher in me would say they've got a lot of things in play but they could do better, and they need to bring some of those things actually into play. So there's a whole, I made a list of things before which I won't go through, but they've got a whole lot of things in play. You talked about the border stuff and the land stuff, putting property rights at the forefront of any environmental legislation that we have. Well, those things that are really, really important, they have a much bigger effect on farming as part of our community than they have on any other sector of the community. You get the odd developer that's knocking up house sections on the outskirts of Auckland, grizzling about the RMA and how clunky and how slow it is. Well, he's got no idea what farmers have been putting up with for the last 20 years of straight BS and the impost of the RMA and our urban friends and the hypocrisy expecting us to give away our ability to make a return on the land that we've invested in so that they can have their chocolate box features and pay nothing for them. It's absolutely, it's despicable, and it needs to be called for what it is. And it's good to see property rights coming back into the forefront.
Yeah. 100%, Charlie. And, you know, I look at 30 years of the RMA, 33 years of the RMA, and there's nothing that Feds hasn't been consistent on around the RMA. We've noted that the property rights was full compensation for takings for property rights under the RMA was never in it, and it's been a bone of contention. If we can get it in, it might just slow this nonsense down, because you and I and everybody else wants to be able to use it, whether you're an urban, a homeowner, a business, a commercial developer, you want to be able to use or find the property potential you desire. But as you've just said, so many people living in a protected environment try to sort of closet us from being able to have our full potential extracted from our land. And I know that as soon as I use that word extracted, there'll be people saying, he's big on extraction. Well, that's what we do as a society. Everything's about using the environment. And so, you know, you've all got a very consistent view, and I've got adding a little bit more. I think if we were to set the program for the government of the day, the four of us, we'd actually do quite a good job, and it would cost them a whole lot less. But bureaucrats are very slow to move, aren't they? The same old machinery that's in behind the parliament is still there unless you do the big bang clean out. And that seems to be very hard to do. How do you view that, Owen? You've been in the coalface of parliament.
Yeah, it is a tough thing to do. And, you know, I think since Helen Clark expanded the public service pretty dramatically, and then Jacinda came in and took it even further numerically, what we've got now is not just people who determine policy and do analysis on policy and policy creation. We've got people called comms. And related kind of PR stuff, who are dictating to a large extent what happens. I mean, even in the private sector, too many companies today are dependent on a handful of people who churn out, press releases with gay abandon, and they come to a point where, you know, what can we say next? So, yes, it's difficult shifting the bureaucrats, and we shouldn't underestimate that. But it gets back to the fact about leadership and the strength of the leadership. And you can make things happen if you're decisive, but more importantly, if you come at it from first principles. And too often, our leadership in government are really about what's achievable, tinkering, finger in the air kind of things, rather than starting on the basis of what are the key principles and adhering to those. And I'll pick up on Charlie's point about the media. I don't know of a time that I can remember when a media has been generally so antagonistic towards government, any government. We've got the Herald, who's got a daily cartoon ridiculing the Prime Minister, even when it's not deserved, ridiculing the government. Ultimately, the government needs a media. Not doesn't have to be in their pocket, but they have to be able to get their message out. And the media have been so anti that it's made it really difficult. And I think half of Luxon's sort of low ratings are in actual fact nothing to do with his performance, but everything to do with the evil way the media, the mainstream media, of attacking him relentlessly.
And so what if we're to go back to some of the key issues, of course we have the standard issues like policing, like education. I mean, truancy has been an appalling thing, and Act's trying to get that sorted out, and we've got the charter schools back on the go. Policing the health system, we're trying to reform that and get it back so there's no separate sort of health system, one for Maori and one for the rest. But going to the primary sector, what is it that the primary sector really needs to, of all the things that are in play, what is it? Aside from the RMA, and Charlie, you've alluded to that, and in fact, we've all talked about it, what's the next tier of things that we need to perhaps have access to that we don't at the moment? And perhaps I'll fly a kite here. The GE discussion is big time in terms of some of our RCR listeners, actually. They're quite concerned about GE. What's your take, Katie, on what GE might do for the country and GMO and gene editing, for instance? What good would that do for us?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is the clarity about what it is and what it isn't, I guess, is something that people need to understand and get rid of the fear that they've got around some of that. And like you mentioned, the old CRISPR, the gene editing part, and, you know, that's just selective breeding sped up 1,000 times and done very specifically. You know, you can pick the letter out of the 1,000 chapter book that you want to change versus, you know, throw it in the air and hope you get the right page and get the right result through mutagenesis, etc. So, you know, that if people actually had a little bit more understanding of how far it's moved in the time we've had a moratorium and all those things on, they might be pleasantly surprised. But also, and because of that, that's the way forward in my thinking, where you can potentially, and I have seen some of the grasses that have been developed in New Zealand in plots in Uruguay when I was over there a number of years ago, doing the next stage is the growth, testing them in the field basically, that we can't do here, where they're drought resistant, insect resistant, you know, they will last longer, less fertilizer, all those things that make them more economically viable, and probably improve marginal land actually as well. That's very interesting for where ag can go. And I mean, you see what the plant breeders do with kiwi fruit, all the different colors, all those different things. That they are looking at different genes in animals and for the breeding out or making which ones are more methane tolerant or can do better with those grasses, the grasses themselves. But so there's a lot of scope in there to improve what we've got and not in the scary Frankenstein way. So I think that's a big conversation we need to have. And I know being tied up with Predator Free, there's a bit of work that's going on there with the gene drive, whether you could actually, you know, get rid of one of the pests that way. The current tools and tech we've got, they've moved in a different direction and we can probably do a lot without it. But you still, if you're going to explore it and understand it, it's a long time frame before you get these things to a point where people and the legislation means it's safe and you're okay to you've tested that it's okay in your environment. So we should be doing more in that area. And if you put the right protocols and things around it, you can make sure that what is developed is useful and is sustainable and practical and all those things and, you know, do it methodically and go about it. But sitting back and going, no, not for us, is a lost opportunity.
Yeah, so just before I go to Charlie on that, around your predator-free work, are you talking about gene technology to get rid of, say, possums and stoats and things like that? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, but doing some work around rats and mice, actually, on the back of it's we're putting a bit of funding into a university in Adelaide because, of course, mice are a terrible problem for agriculture in Australia. So, yeah.
Yeah, so look, that was in play, some of that was in play 20 years ago, and boy, it just takes you, I'm trying to sort of flesh out, listeners, that this just doesn't happen overnight. There is a lot of protocols to go through to get to the next step, and if New Zealand doesn't want to do it, well, we're going to be shut out. But that's my view, and of course, there's plenty of people in New Zealand that would rather have this little island state down here that you know, wants to go, well, avoid the evolution of technology and ideas, and yet we expect to be sort of wrapped up in cotton wool.
Can again, I just throw one more in there?
Sure.
You know, imagine if we can produce that grass that can suck enough nitrogen out of the atmosphere, because that's, of course, what the atmosphere is mainly made of, that it can self-sustain itself and you basically need no fertilizer. How good would that be, given that we have supply chain issues that pop up from time to time and we don't make the same amount of resource in New Zealand? Most of it has to come in because, as you said, extractive before is not a word we do in New Zealand very well. That would mean we could continue on doing stuff that we do now, you know, that we have to, you know, replace those imports. So there's some pretty super-duper stuff there if we're willing to have a good crack at seeing if it can be done.
Now, Charlie, we had a chat off air about this. You've got some very good view. You know, you've got some long held views on this because you were at the coalface of that big Royal Commission way back, 1998 to 2002 or thereabouts. What's your view on the GE opportunity for this country?
My main view is that I needed more haircuts back then than I do now. But what I would say to the opponents of anything GE is, given that it's widespread in the rest of the world and we're a standout in our ability not to use it or embrace it in New Zealand, I would say to the opponents of GE, what is the big problem that you've seen in the rest of the world that means that you won't support GE improvements being used in New Zealand? So that's the position I would come at it from, because when we had the Royal Commission into genetic engineering, we had groups like the 240-odd general practitioners against genetic engineering, and their at the Royal Commission, you know, their representative sat there knitting away while she was being reading their submission, and they were an interesting group of people. And we had other people like Klaus Amann from the Amish community in the USA that came out, and they were one of the first farming groups in the world to seize upon the opportunities of GE. Remember that the Amish people basically started the organic movement, and so they saw GE as an opportunity for them to even up the playing field between them and chemical using farmers, and they first farmed GE potatoes and found them very much to their liking. So the opponents of GE are really without any scientific foundation that I can see about what is the problem with GE. We've had 30 years of it now where we've got some optics. What was being said might happen? What were the dangers? Have any of those things happened? Do we still have all the insects in the world that we had then? Yes, we do. Has the monarch butterfly gone into extinction as predicted by most GE opponents back then? No, it hasn't. That was all absolute rubbish, but it was widely believed and widely repeated by the anti-GE movement. They're actually an absolute disgrace of a group, and they need to come clean and say that they were wrong.
Well, I might put in a slightly counter view here, because I think people have a cynical view. Seeing some of the other things that have happened in the world with GMO, I can speak from the case, the classic case of the BT cotton in India, which has been a failure over time. There have been similar experiences by farmers in Africa with some of the genetically modified seeds being pushed. But yet, you know, that is different from what we see in the New Zealand context. There is also this thing about the methane genetics. You know, we are, most of us, most of the people in the farming community today, if I speak to people around me, they are not completely sure what we are breeding those animals for, the low methane genetics that we seem to covet. Owen, you might have a view on this being also the chair of the Methane Science Accord. Because when we look at GE, some of the things that are currently underway, for which we farmers are footing the bill, be it through entities like AgriZero, which I might add, despite the coming of the new government, there have been no rollbacks in the amount of funding that's been going on there to somehow lead us to this climate nirvana. All of this sullies the water where GE and, you know, the public's view on GE is concerned. Owen, your thoughts, has the coalition been able to rein in some of these entities?
I wish we could say yes, but the answer really is very simply no. I mean, I think this government came in believing that mitigation was the way to go, that irrespective of where the science was and what came out of the science, even going forward, I think they decided that the appropriate place for New Zealand was to have a strong mitigation program, and they've continued to invest in it. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if one of the main planks coming out of the panel investigation led by, Nicola Shadbolt will be that we continue with mitigation, that we, you know, stuff boluses down our 800 kilogram bulls three or four times a year. We round all our stock up and bring them in and vaccinate them again and again. So, I'd like to think we've made progress on that front, and that when, you know, New Zealand's leading climate scientist comes out and says that the total amount of warming from New Zealand ruminants in any one year is about 0.004°. And you know, you'd rather hope that people said, well, yeah, that's pretty absurd. It's inconsequential. It's immeasurable. We need to take a different angle. And, you know, maybe GE fits into that scene as well in some forms down the track. But right now, I must say, I'm a little bit negative about what we've been able to do in pushing the government back, particularly around those mitigation issues.
Yeah, and of course, just going and reading through the ACT part of the coalition agreement, it says it was wanted to pass legislation to complete the removal of agriculture from the emissions trading scheme. Well, we would have said hooray for that, I would have thought, although there is some farmers who are saying, yes, we can, and, you know, we're going to get a market premium, so look, let's fall into line and let's measure something. Well, and the second part of their agreement was finalise the development of farm level emissions measurement methodology. And that had me hemorrhaging because the two are a contradiction. You just, one's right, get rid of it. The other one, you can do it as a voluntary measure, but don't ever have the need to have some government agency finalising the development of farm level emissions methodology. Now, I see you nodding, Owen, but Katie, do you agree with that? Do you agree with what I've just said? I mean, because to me, it's a big ticket item that the farmers of New Zealand just aren't really sure about yet.
Yeah, and I actually believe that there's some progress on removing agriculture from the ETS coming up very shortly, is my understanding, which will be great. Mm. So watch that space. But actually, there's another piece I want to throw in here, and I don't want to harp on about predator control, but I just look at the investment going into all these things and knowing that the sequestration of carbon, we remove all the possums out of the forest, which we're doing, and now there's ungulates and all sorts that are really starting to hammer the forest in New Zealand. Things have got away over COVID. Pigs, you name it, they're all out there destroying it, and I see it all the time, and on farmland as well, not just the native forest and the pine and all the rest of it. That sequestration, we're actually proving we're doing the work on now, is real. I don't know how long you could claim it because you've got a recovering phase in your forest, but you know, we've got a shoestring budget to carry on doing this, and if we're going to reach 2050, you know, predator free, we have to ramp it up. And I see that some of this investment in mitigation that's probably chasing windmills in some cases. I mean, after a vaccine for how long? Yes, and yes, you can use some Acinopholophagus, how we say that, seaweed. Some of the active ingredient is supposed to be carcinogenic, etc. So if some of the investment went into, killing more vermin in the forest, we could actually have a positive balance and earn money from it for New Zealand. So we're missing a big piece of the pie.
So you're a supporter of the measurement of all that stuff, so that you would say, in terms of the New Zealand balance, carbon dioxide balance sheet, it's important.
If we're going to continue on down that track of the treaties that we've signed up to, why wouldn't you measure it and get a return on it? And if you've got a revenue stream there, or even if it's a neutral balance, that's great. And knowing there's biodiversity issues there as well, which the world is just starting to really get into, and we're still sort of, I feel, maybe a little bit asleep at the wheel. We've got an opportunity here that we need to leap on, because it'll fix up that's coming at us at a great rate of knots too.
So, Charlie, how do you view all this stuff? Effectively, you know, I think we're all want to run individual businesses. We really that's why we were probably the president of Fed Farmers. We're individuals in our own right. We understand property rights. We understand the rights and responsibilities that go with that. Is there any need for this farm level emissions measurement in a compulsory sort of setting? You want to do it yourself, go fill your boots. Do you think there's a need to do that? And the ACT Party sort of saying they want to finalise the development of farm level emissions measurement methodology. Do you think that's a vital plank for them to stand on?
No, I have serious misgivings about it, Don. Similar to your own, really. If you want to do it, fine. Work out how you're going to do it. But once you give a recipe for something, then you actually stifle further further development and further opportunity for farmers to come up with more individual responses to things. So I don't think that I don't want to see that happen. We know that we are responsible to do something, and we know that we're already in a very good position as a country compared to all other countries as far as we can see. So I really am against some sort of prescriptive way of doing things, and I'm not quite sure why ACT, given its kind of capitalist view of things, are so keen, and other things are so keen to have a prescription for this.
Mm.
Do you think because eventually, you know, the worm always turns and no one stays in power forever, and that actually having something that's semi-sensible, this is just the old, you know, let's just put do the devil's advocate thing, that makes sense a little bit, might be better the devil you know than one that the other, you know, new coalition of whatever it is, say the Greens and the Party Māori come in and they want bang, 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 this, this and this, and you are a lamb to the slaughter.
Okay, well, Katie, I think this, I actually, that might be, might give them the benefit of the doubt and say that is the way they're thinking. But it's a contradiction if you think about it and to how they're looking at education.
I do agree.
So the way they're looking at education, you know, and I was a special needs teacher. That was my first job. So I have a love of learning and teaching. And I think that our schools in New Zealand have really, really gone lost ground over the last 20 or 25 years. And was one of the reasons why I gave up teaching. Actually, I was so despondent about the way that schools were heading and how highly unionised. The teaching workforce in New Zealand is the most unionised, most organised union and most doctrinaire union in the whole country. There's nothing that make the water siders and the freezing workers look like children. But anyway, they're very, very tough and very, very organised. So the only way you can undo all that system is to put a privately owned competitor in their midst. So that there's a solution to what's going on in education, set up some charter schools. Now, and all of the and David Seymour was quite correct. The teachers railing against the idea of charter schools is not driven by teachers' fear that they will fail. Their fear is that they will succeed and show them up for the great waste of taxpayer money and opportunity for our children that they are. And I know, you know, many people are captive in that process and don't think much about it. But the charter school idea, the idea that, you know, Chrissy and I here in Foxton where we live could set up our own a private school, get the funding that the local public schools do, and have a go at doing a better job. So I think that's a real, you know, competition is the way, you know, if we want to solve the problem of long drawn out processes for certifying buildings under construction, then, you know, privatise it, take it out of the hands of the councils. I think that'll be a model which the government could use to actually unpack a whole lot of the stuff. Are there any private hospitals that are failing? No, not really. And why are public hospitals failing then? Because the funding stream, what they earn is really no different. So it's just, I think we really need to think about this stuff. And I can't spot why the contradiction in ACT's policy of from GE to, for example, as I've just the example I've just used, education.
Mm. Yeah, it's none of this is easy obviously the politicians. They've got competing interests, different factions coming at them from all angles. So I suppose we have to cut them some slack. But from where I sit, after, and I'm sure Owen and all of us, we see things so easily black and white, black from white, and it's just not that. There's so many shades of grey that elements put in the mix. One. Sorry, Jaspreet, I'm hogging all this. You've got a question.
I guess this is my opinion, that this government has not reined back the power of the NGOs, currently in the country. And I know it's a small country, but this massive open door, the current director of WWF New Zealand is the ex-policy head of policy for Department of Conservation. I listened recently to a research piece from Motu Research. This was just last night. I was listening to it. And they spoke, this particular webinar was about working how offshore climate mitigation action, because Motu Research says our new forestry is not going on fast enough. Now, Susie Kerr, who was speaking, with all due respect, she has also been working with the Environmental Defense Society. So Motu Research, which further gives over opinions to our government, is being funded by an NGO there. There is, even if you look at the climate minister, James Shaw's secretary, I believe until recently, and I think even right now, the secretary, James Shaw, has currently Minister Simon Watts has. We are not changing all of this. And to expect that things will change, whereas, you know, one thing that the government has changed and everything's going to change, the bureaucrats and the NGOs are extremely, extremely powerful. And how long are we going to keep saying that this is a small country and, you know, this is the only talent we have? Beyond a point, for me, there is such massive conflicts of interest that some of this is absolutely unconscionable. I don't even know how it's going on in plain sight.
You young people can't remember all that happened in 1984. I've got a very clear memory of it. And what that government did, rightly or wrongly, was move in big steps very quickly. They communicated effectively and they got on because they had a set of underlying principles that they were wedded to. And policy becomes a lot easier to form and deliver if it comes from a principled position.
Yeah. Yes.
It's when you're trying to please everybody that you run into all manner of problems, trying to straddle too many, you know, ride too many horses at once. It just becomes far too difficult. So, you know, I must say that the national government on its own has never been a reforming government. Any reforms in New Zealand, I hate to admit this, have been done by the Labor governments, and even the bad reforms. So we really need ACT to come through with a bit of help from Winston and his team sometimes, because I don't think National really got the stomach to go a lot further than just a tinkering level.
Okay. Yeah, look, and yeah, we're running out of time for this this show, but you know, one thing we haven't talked about, and if we could do it quickly, the legislative privilege was given to CO2 forestry. I hate calling it carbon forestry because it's really CO2 they're trying to suck up. Anyway, in 2008, and it's had a few iterations since, but we've seen the return of land that may have once been bush, to back into pine trees. And we've now seen in Southland last week, I'm told, 6,000 hectares of very nice rolling land was readying itself to be planted into pines for next season. That's gone on unabated. And we've seen the sunk cost in the sheep and beef industry processing capacity have to be downsized time after time. What do you think the government could do to stem that flow? I mean, do they want to? Do they want to get rid of ruminant agriculture off the face of the country?
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? And number one, you know, willing seller, willing buyer. I firmly believe in that. When you want to retire, whoever's going to pay you the most, you're going to go there. So we've created this beast. But at the same time, planners all around the country are picking up the easy way out that other councils have done, and they're bringing it through into and taking more and more property rights away. Just the bugbear of mine currently, you know, at the moment we can subdivide down to 1 hectare if we want. That's going to be changed to 20. That's in our one plan that's coming through, hasn't gone through yet. But it speaks to this in a different way. I don't know how many of those places that have had the swathes of pine trees come through have already got that, because I believe this is a that's come through from the Gisborne end. that you can only go down to 20 hectares. Well, though, that makes the land unfarmable anyway as well, unless you're in a great area where you can do horticulture and do your all those other lovely fruits and different things. Where I am, you can't. You've got to grow pasture or you've got to do some best practice mining or something like that to keep your living. But if we could still do, cut off the odd 1 hectare block of marginal land that you're not going to miss on your farm, you retain, you get some income, it may be temporary, but you get a nice little dollop that might keep you going, might enable you to actually retire or do run not so intensive as in not such a costly operation that doesn't make any money for some sheep and beef farms, sorry to say. So we're possibly, I think, we're looking at some of this in the wrong way. We've got to actually make it so that it's easier for people to utilise their land more fully in a variety of ways, give them back that choice, those property rights, versus lock people in. And I worry if we try to shift the scrum back so that we don't see our sheep and beef disappearing under trees, we'll lock ourselves into something else that still doesn't work. So it's a really difficult question. And it comes back to, how do you make those bloody markets pay you a good price, you know, for your produce, and you'll stick to it?
Yeah. Wow. Don, I was on a farm in Queensland the other day that has measured independently 20 tonnes of carbon sequestered. That's equivalent to almost 50 tonnes of CO2 out of the atmosphere in 1 year. Now, forestry can't do that. Planting trees on good rolling, you know, sheep country will never achieve that level of sequestration. All we need is the facts on the table, the truth to come out, and the market to take care of it. And look, there's work being done all over the world now, particularly in the US and in Scotland of all places, showing that, for example, crushed basalt rock can improve the uptake of carbon dramatically. So there are new ideas, new technologies coming through and stuff the trees. They're going to ruin our countryside, ruin our landscape, bring gorse back, multiply Katie's possums. Absolutely stupid idea.
Biohazard.
And before we go to Charlie, I just want to put in my pennies worth there. I mean, I've got to sort of chastise you two, Katie and Owen, a little bit, because you seem to be falling into line with the concept that this is a sensible concept, that we should be worried about CO2 in the atmosphere. We should be worried about the use of all this stuff, when in actual fact, CO2 is the fertilizer of life. So so it seems that you're falling into line with the compliance. I'm giving you a wee smack back just for the moment. I accept that we're all in this together. So, Charlie, a final comment from you, because we definitely need to wrap this up. What do you see as the impediments to getting, you know, perhaps the land use mix stabilized in this country, you know, so that the pine tree blight doesn't keep going?
Well, I'm obviously reasonably right wing, more than some of you in this discussion. I believe in the free market, and I think that what we have in New Zealand and in many countries is meddling in the market, and they've actually prescribed in detail how the world is going to respond to this CO2 problem. I'm not saying I said perceived CO2 problem. And so I think that the answer is to let also lots of people do lots of different things, and then, as Owen was just alluding to, measure, and see what's going on. And on our original old dairy farm, which was very poor sand country, 5 km from the Tasman Sea, just raw sand. It was, you know, when we started farming there, with rabbits were taking a cut lunch, as the saying used to be. And we put centre pivots on there 25 years ago, and that raw sand has now got a black soil 250 millimetres thick. So what is that soil? Where did it come from? How did that occur? and what is it, and how much has been sequestered in that process. It's not counted. It's not allowed to be counted under the book. And it's absolute rubbish that a neighbour with some poor sand country who's not allowed to irrigate anymore because there's kind of a moratorium that was put on by David Parker, they're thinking about planting that in trees. Now, that's just a tragedy when it could be do a much better job for everybody, including future earnings for the country. So it's these stupid rules and bureaucrats getting in the way of allowing scientists and farmers to come up with different ideas about how to achieve whatever the goal is that's being tried to be met.
Yeah.
And no, Don, if somebody will pay me $70 a ton to put a bit of fertilizer on the ground that will produce, it will suck 20 tons of carbon dioxide out of the air.
I'm worried about you, and I'm worried. I thought I had you on side. Hey, look, isn't it great that we can all have this chat and put up ideas that you actually don't hear ever in mainstream media? There's never a chance to debate the big issues like this. And I think, I hope listeners have enjoyed this chat. We started off talking about the good, the bad, and the indifferent about the coalition, and we ended up on this subject. All vital stuff. We've spoken to Katie Milne, Charlie Pedersen, and Owen Jennings, all former presidents of Fed Farmers, all with a wealth of experience. And it's just great to have you back on RCR doing this for us because, yeah, we have an eclectic listenership, I think, and they need to hear this stuff. So fantastic. Thanks for coming back on RCR Greenwashed, and let's hope we don't have to wait 365 days for the next update. See you soon.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.